Hi, and welcome to Inference, an AI business podcast by Silo AI. I'm Ville Hulkko, co-founder of Silo, the largest private AI lab in the Nordics that focuses on building human-centric AI for businesses. With the Inference podcast, we introduce a number of topics and people of the global AI scene that every business decision maker should know. With me today is Ville Tuulos. Ville is best known for his work as the manager of machine learning infrastructure at Netflix. At Netflix, he was responsible for the genesis and operations of Metaflow, Netflix's machine learning workflow infrastructure. Ville can be considered one of the most influential Finns in the global machine learning scene. Already in 2011, Ville set out to establish a machine learning infrastructure company to serve the budding market of AI. Serving AdRoll's machine learning needs, Ville quickly became one of the most appreciated ML engineers in Silicon Valley and ended up at Netflix. Now, Ville is spinning out a new AI toolkit company while also publishing a book on machine learning deployment. Ville, finally, it's great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Ville, and like, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I touched upon your CV just superficially, but it would be tremendous if you could also introduce yourself. So who are you?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So yes, as you mentioned, like until very recently, I used to lead machine learning infrastructure at Netflix, and I guess Netflix probably doesn't need introduction here. So but prior to Netflix, I had been working on actually like machine learning infrastructure for a long time, kind of even longer than I dare to mention. But it has been a topic that has been always very close to my heart. Like I started my career at University of Helsinki. I was there at the research group, like we're doing things related to Bayesian statistics, some amount of neural networks as well, actually like prior to that at the startup called GuruSoft, like related to self-organizing maps a long time ago. But now, I mean, like here in Silicon Valley, I've been really focusing on companies and their needs when it comes to large scale machine learning and data science. And I've been super fascinated about all the changes that have happened over the past couple of years. The industry has really advanced quite a bit. So.
Now, Netflix is one of the most globally known machine learning houses, I would argue, as an applicator. And known primarily for its recommendation system. But within the AI scene, the thing that Netflix is truly known for is Metaflow. Can you talk a little bit about your previous role at Netflix and explain Metaflow?
So it's actually a fascinating story. I believe that like many listeners can learn from that as well. So like as many people know, Netflix has been doing recommendations, like basically those personalized TV and movie recommendations you see like when you log into Netflix.com for a long time. Actually, I think that Netflix started working on that over 10 years ago. So it has been kind of a crown jewel of the whole company and all the machine learning efforts for the longest time. But now, and this was about like 2017, so about maybe four almost 5 years ago, the company started realizing that there are opportunities for machine learning outside this like one use case as well. And especially as Netflix started becoming one of the largest movie and TV studios in the world, they realized that like we can optimize all parts of the company's operations using machine learning and data science and different optimization techniques. So it's really not only like one application, the recommendations where we can use machine learning in. And now like with that idea, like came the question that, okay, so we have a number of people who need to work on these different use cases. How do we actually make them maximally productive? How do we actually help them in building and before even like building the applications, like kind of running experiments that like which one of these opportunities are actually most promising? And this was the situation when I joined Netflix in 2017 with this idea that we have to do something. And interestingly, if you remember like the overall like landscape in 2017, there were some nascent projects out there, like open source projects. There were some offerings by some commercial vendors, but it was still quite nascent at the time. And in this context, my team at Netflix started building Metaflow, which is our answer to this question that, okay, so we have a very diverse set of use cases for ML and data science at the company. And how do we make people productive in actually like trying to address all these different use cases? And the realization that we had is that like building infrastructure of this nature is a bit different than building infrastructure for a specific use case, like what we had done with recommendations before. So basically, as of today, Netflix kind of has two sides. There's still the, of course, like all the recommendations, like we put a lot of effort in them. It's super important for the company. But then there's everything else, kind of like what happens below the surface under the hood, where like we have hundreds of different use cases for machine learning that are today powered by Metaflow.
Now that's really interesting. And if we kind of take a dive under the surface a bit towards those things that you mentioned that are not necessarily visible, at least to the consumer who's using Netflix, but rather on the operational side, can you give us some examples of how machine learning is being used at the kind of the less apparent components of Netflix today?
So the interesting thing about Netflix is that while the company is these days quite huge and global, so forth, I mean, the business at the end of the day is somewhat simple. I mean, Netflix's mission is to entertain the world. And to do that, like the company produces many, many TV shows and movies every year. And now, if you think of a life cycle of, let's say, a movie or a TV show, like from the very beginning, so how it works is that there are different people, companies who pitch different ideas to Netflix that here's a great idea for a TV show and movie. And of course, the company at some point has to decide like which one of those ideas are like really worth investing in. And one of the most fascinating, like kind of a machine learning applications, actually, like, and one of the most important use cases for Metaflow as well, is this question that like, how does Netflix decide what to produce? And there's actually a very complex set of models, I mean, like probably hundreds and hundreds of models, like looking at this question from different aspects, that how can we predict like kind of what kind of a content would be most appealing to our members? And that's definitely, I mean, at the very beginning, I mean, even before nothing has been produced, I mean, like we have to kind of make the decision. And of course, it's not computers, it's not machine learning systems that make the decision by themselves. But basically, these models produce input for humans, human decision makers, so that they can kind of then assess like the computer's prediction, like and their own, like whatever, like a human judgment they want to put in to make then the final decision. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it is really not like computers making these calls, but I mean, it is a collaboration between humans and these models like making the choices. But that's only the first thing. I mean, then after that, I mean, like as we start like producing the movie, it's actually fascinating like how complex process and like how many hundreds of people are needed to, let's say, produce a TV show or a movie. And they're actually like one of the use cases that really fascinated me a lot is this idea that actually just optimizing production schedules, who needs to be where and when actually like shooting a movie, is a surprisingly complex problem, a complex optimization problem. And we had some like really smart data scientists working on optimization algorithms that can like kind of optimize the production schedule. So that's pretty fascinating as well. Then there's a ton of things related to computer vision, natural language processing that like we can use in like a very specific use cases. And I think, I mean, oftentimes when I talk to people, many people think that, oh, it's the kind of the AI like creating the movie or like replacing the actors. But it's actually like the tiniest little things. I mean, like across the whole like a production life cycle, like where ML and AI can be applied. And the idea is always that like by automating away the boring parts of the production process, then we can give the people, the humans, I mean, more creative freedom to kind of really do what they do well, which is usually like something that like at least as of today, it's only humans that can do like all the creative stuff and of course acting. And yeah, no, I mean, I could keep going, but I mean, like there are like really literally hundreds of use cases. So
I gotta say your example kind of touches me on a personal level. And I do have to share a short story here because prior to the foundation of Silo AI, I used to live in Silicon Valley as well with my previous company, Valossa, and we were building a video analysis platform. So multimodal analysis on video, everything that is visible, everything is audible, everything that is readable, and so forth, extracted from the video itself. So time-coded scene-level metadata generation. And our core target market was media. So we would go to content creation companies, we would go to studios, broadcasters, and so forth. And we would pitch this solution of implementing deep data science into extracting more intelligence out of the content itself. And I recall the first time when I went to my first big movie studio meeting. So I go there and I have this whole pitch prepared. And I go in and I pitch the case of how data science and content analytics is going to bring more intelligence into how content can be targeted, what sort of content choices work and which ones don't work, and just simple workflow, you know, solving simple workflow issues there. And I go about my pitch, and once I finish, the VP is sitting across to me, and he sits and he looks at me and he says, "Ville, no creative will ever let an algorithm be a part of the creative process." And that was it. The meeting was there. But I took some pointers to my sales pitch, and the, later ones went a little bit better. But, you know, hearing your story about, you know, how AI is not the driven part, but it's just an enabler across the whole tree of, you know, going everything from content creation to data aggregation into validation methods, but also just into the, kind of the mundane little things in the everyday life. At least to me, it looks like this is the modern way of doing AI. Because, you know, from 2017 to 2019, AI was the big hype thing. Like, oh, it's coming now, it's transforming industries. But now when the hype is starting to become reality, what we end up is sometimes just a million marginal things that became marginally better. Not necessarily transformations, but things that became more efficient. And from these small streams, big victories are achieved. But there was something there that you mentioned about kind of enabling the human side and enabling the people side, which I think is a beautiful transition to our actual topic of discussion today, which is the experimentation culture within Netflix, how you manage it, what it's like, and how to nurture it. Because, you know, we could talk about toolkitting all day, but at the end of the day, what I think we share a mutual passion in is the human side of how do you actually manage the process and how do you do it in such a way that it becomes empowering instead of a scientific exercise. Can you introduce us to Netflix's experimentation culture and its relationship to machine learning?
Yeah. Well, that's a really broad and deep question. And as you pointed out, of course, there's the technical side of things. There are things where infrastructure, like where different, like kind of the ways how we enable people to do these things, where they can help. And then there's the culture, the kind of the more like a philosophical side of how the company is organized. And for those who don't know, Netflix actually like has quite a special culture. I mean, not in the sense that like any of the things that Netflix does today would be radically different than like what many other modern companies, especially here in Silicon Valley, do. But I mean, for one, I mean, Netflix started nurturing the culture very deliberately already a long time ago. And it is something that is extremely important for the company. So there's actually like a book that Reed Hastings published a short while ago, maybe a year ago, called No Rules Rules, which means that there are actually like very few rules overall, like very few processes. I mean, you would be surprised that like given the company of that size, like how like a few processes of any kind there are in the company. And I think like when it comes to like experimentation culture, I mean, like you kind of need to have a good baseline. So if your company is extremely rigid and like if you have like processes for everything, I don't know, like how you can like really nurture the experimentation culture in such an environment. It might be that I just haven't seen it. It might be possible, but the kind of the culture that I saw at Netflix, I mean, it starts with this idea of freedom and responsibility. So basically, it means that like every data scientist, every employee, every single person, like kind of in different parts of this like a value chain, they have in some sense, I mean, it sounds crazy, but I mean, infinite amount of freedom to do their job, like however they see fit. And then on the other hand, like there's the responsibility, of course, to do what's right for Netflix, what's right for a company. I mean, at the end of the day, it is the company like paying their salary. So and that kind of like is the baseline, the kind of the mindset like where we start from. Now, there are like a couple of other things that I really would like to highlight that are maybe less obvious. I mean, one of them, which is really important, is that the company's business model is surprisingly simple. I mean, as you know, I mean, Netflix is a subscription-based model. I mean, it's kind of for a company like that, it's quite easy to measure, like, let's say, what's the lifetime value of a single member, like what really matters, like for the company financially. And this shouldn't be underestimated in the sense that, of course, at the end of the day, if you really want to have a true experimentation culture, that it really kind of penetrates the whole organization, I mean, that needs to be aligned with the business. And one challenge is that like many businesses are simply so complex that it is hard for any individual even to understand that like what drives really the company's revenue, what drives the lifetime value. And in such an environment, it is hard to make sure that like individuals can even like think about the experiments that would make sense. So I think that is surprisingly important and like surprisingly kind of a uniquely fun at Netflix that like the company, the business is quite understandable. And then like the another mindset is, of course, the kind of the growth mindset. So, I mean, Reed Hastings always kept saying that we absolutely suck today compared to what we will be in 5 years. So, like for a company like Netflix, it would be easy to say that we are already amazing. Like we are bigger and better than anybody else. And hence, I mean, it's mainly about coasting on our kind of like a past achievements. But I mean, that's not the mindset at all. I mean, of course, you want to kind of keep people hungry. You want to kind of really instill the notion that like we are kind of still, I mean, just about to get started, which I mean, feeds into that idea that yes, I mean, experiments are needed. So I think that those are like kind of the raw ingredients that like kind of go into that. And I'm happy to talk more like kind of how it looks like more on the kind of the actual execution side, if you want to go deeper into that question. So.
Yes, please. I think that would be tremendously interesting, because I think this is the point where we're kind of getting to a pretty sweet intersection, if you will. Because, for example, with Silo AI, a lot of the work that we do consultatively with organizations that are, you know, some of them are very advanced and have their own private AI labs, and some of them are less so, which means that every single culture interaction you kind of need to build in a very specific way, and the amount of hierarchy and routine and structure is a very unique thing. So it would be tremendously interesting to hear about how the practicalities go at Netflix.
Well, I mean, I can give you like a little bit of context of my role. So again, I mean, my role there as a part of the machine learning infrastructure team or the platform was to work with all data scientists at the company in all like different departments. So that was actually like super fascinating. So like working with people who work on the production side of things, like I mentioned, also on the marketing side, like people who like work on like the infrastructural side of things. So it really like spanned the whole business. And now like each one of these departments, of course, like have a set of things that they are interested in of their own. And they are, of course, like fully responsible for those. And there is no like a centralized planning committee, like determining that these are the things we want to do. So it's really like almost a chaotic, like a very large, diverse set of different use cases. And now, as from my point of view, I mean, how I viewed like all of these cases is that I always considered that it's basically a funnel. It's a funnel in a sense that like all of these different teams and departments, they have a crazy number of different ideas that they might think are potentially useful. And of course, like individuals come up with new ideas all the time that we could use ML there, we could use AI there. I mean, there's a new data set. I mean, what could we do with it and so forth. But I mean, of course, all these ideas are totally unproven until like we actually like see how they work in practice. So that's basically the experimentation funnel. I mean, like all these like hundreds of different teams with each one of them like with hundreds of different ideas what they would like to do. And each one of these teams, they have their own like prioritization process to decide like what other things they want to try most actively. Since, of course, I mean, it is always a resourcing question. You can't test everything at the same time. And then you identify a few projects that seem promising. And that's really like now, I mean, where the infrastructure can start helping. Because, of course, the key idea is that like we want to see and if these ideas work as fast as possible. Because given the great number of ideas at the top of the funnel, if we want to have like any chance to kind of test many of these ideas in a finite amount of time, we can't spend too much time on like just testing one idea. And this used to be actually a key problem in the past, that even building a single machine learning application, like taking a data set, understanding the data set, building a model, and then not only like building the model and like having it in a notebook, but actually like connecting the results to an actual business process. Since like when we talk about experimentation, we are not saying that, okay, can we build a model? Yes, of course, we can always build a model. But the question is that, can we test if it actually helps the business? And that's the key question, that like we kind of want to hold like end-to-end solution, but I mean without spending too much time on it. And that's really the crazy part, and like that used to be extremely extremely time consuming in the past, involving many different people. And that is like one area like where Metaflow can really help, that like when we want to take these projects like from prototype to somewhat production, in a sense that like we can at least see if they produce business value, that was like something that we really focused on. And I oftentimes joked that like my job was to make data scientists fail fast, which means that really the key idea with these experiments is that like it's totally fine to fail, but we want to fail in a useful way. We want to learn something. Every failure is a learning opportunity, and that really requires that like we took the project to the very end, so we really understand like kind of the implications all the way through, and then we see that, okay, does this actually make sense? And like oftentimes, as expected, it happened that like we saw that, well, I mean, this is actually not the biggest opportunity. Or like what happened most often is that we realized that there are actually some missing components, maybe we miss some data, or maybe some modeling task is way harder than what we expected, and then we move on to the next project. And then, of course, like the other option is that we decide that, oh my gosh, I mean, this is the best idea ever, and we have to keep investing. And that's then like kind of a whole another process that like how we spin out, how we do we spin off like kind of these projects that are most promising and like seem that like, okay, there could be a lot of value there.
And that's a beautiful way of setting up the motivation for Metaflow as well, because essentially scaling out failures, make data scientists fail in a sensible way. The only way you can do that really is to have basically a level playing field and not having to do everything like from scratch. And it's kind of something that we discovered as well in the work that we do. So we've implemented something that is called the Silo operating software, Silo OS, which basically exists exactly for the same reason. So, you know, when you work with a multitude of clients instead of like an internal organization, all of the environments are different, but the problems are essentially the same, that you can't rely on a single model, you have to rely on rapid testing. But if there's no infrastructure available at the client side, like how do you go about setting up that iterative testing environment? But basically, you know, going back to the whole experimentation culture and why Metaflow was born, that's a tremendous way of explaining it. Can you talk about the talent distribution, if you will, within teams? So obviously, you know, keeping in mind that Netflix is indeed, you know, not just a software organization, but a highly advanced one. But like, how's the distribution of machine learning capability across teams? Is there like a center of excellence, or is there capability within each team?
Yeah, no, and that is a great question as well. And again, like going back in time in 2017, at the time there was the idea, like based on like the experiences, like from like what happened even before that, is that in order to actually like build these experiments, we need people who on the one hand are excellent software engineers, since I mean there was this idea that these are all big data systems, these are all like distributed computing systems. And then we need people who, the same people, I mean, who should be also able to kind of create these like a very fancy models. They should be able to read research papers, and they should be able to implement these things in languages like C++ or Scala or like on Spark and so forth. And now, I mean, Netflix like has been in a happy enough position that like the company was able to hire actually like a really a great organization, like a team of these people, absolutely amazing individuals. But as the company grew, I mean, there was this idea that while on the one hand, like finding these unicorns, like who have PhDs in computer science and machine learning, it is getting increasingly hard. And secondly, there was this question that like in the long term, are is this even the kind of right profile? And like, should we rather have people who have a deep domain expertise in a certain area? And like, would it be actually more beneficial that like, well, I mean, instead of like knowing how to hack C++ and Scala, I mean, what if you knew everything about anime? I mean, what if you knew everything about animation? I mean, like, would it be actually more beneficial for the modeling task? And that was also the mindset, like when we started with 2017, that we can't assume that in the future, like everybody like working on these problems has a PhD in computer science. And somehow we started feeling that like, is that really even necessary? That it just somehow doesn't feel that well aligned with the actual business objective. I mean, whether it's implemented in C++ or Python or whatever else, or even R, I mean, it really shouldn't matter like for the business at all, as long as the results are equally valid. So, and that's like why the kind of the guiding kind of a thought like for Metaflow since the very beginning is that like we want to work with people who have some like a baseline knowledge of programming, in a sense that they can, let's say, hack Python in a notebook. But I mean, by no means they have to be like software engineers by training, or they don't need a degree in computer science. And like we have amazing people now who have a background, let's say, in economics. We have people who have a background in, let's say, more classical statistics. Even people who have different kind of academic backgrounds, like from like kind of a, let's say, from humanities and so forth. And I think that the result is much more interesting than like what it used to be in the past. But of course, in order to be able to now execute these experiments with an organization like this, we really do need infrastructure. And like, it is a fact that like these problems haven't got any less complex fundamentally than what they were before. So still, I mean, like we have distributed systems involved, and still we have a big data involved. It is just now so that like we can leverage kind of infrastructure more to kind of take care of those kind of a more technical side of things. And that's why I've been also, like you mentioned, I mean, I think that there's like a really like a great overlap in interest, like when it comes to this idea of human centricity and the idea that, okay, so can we somehow like raise the level of abstraction to the point that like we can enable and empower a great number of people like from different backgrounds to work on these problems. And that's basically like kind of what we have today. And also another important thing, I mean, going back to what I mentioned about freedom and responsibility, is this idea that we typically don't have teams of any large size, or like kind of teams where we have, let's say, a dedicated ML engineer and dedicated data scientist and dedicated data engineer working on the problem. But rather it is so that we would like to have a single individual to be able to take the kind of the project like from the prototype to production, where production means now like kind of to that point in experimentation where we can get useful results. And that is, again, of course, a great challenge, that like, how do we have a single person be able to do all these things by themselves? So.
And going back to the relationship that you were referencing before, kind of the transition within Netflix of the composition of the people that you're looking for, or the composition of teams rather, you know, there's the ever undying relationship between the people, the team technical expertise who write the code, and then between the people with the domain expertise who necessarily don't write the code. So based on your experiences, like, what's your point of view in making this relationship work?
Yeah, no, I mean, it is definitely a delicate one. Now, I do want to highlight that occasionally we have people who have kind of the both the coding and the domain expertise in the same person. And there the idea really is that, of course, like these days, even like software engineering is really a wide spectrum. And like we have people actually like totally on a kind of in another department. Netflix, of course, is super strong, like when it comes to cloud infrastructure and so forth. We have people who are great systems engineers, and the people, but I mean, people I work with, the people working on these problems, I mean, they typically don't have that skill set, but it's more so that they can express their ideas, let's say, in some like a lightweight Python code. And like, given that that they're like kind of, they don't have to spend day and night thinking about computing side of things, then that allows them to be also domain experts in some fields. So now, that being said, I mean, there are definitely cases, let's say, where we have, let's say, business stakeholders or like really genuine domain experts who are not like writing any code at all. And you know, in some cases they can be kind of a peers, like kind of a maybe somehow kind of a ingesting kind of a multiple sources of information, like where the modeling is one part, or maybe they are just like consumers of the results. I mean, like based on my experience, like one of the most important things in these relationships is kind of, I guess, not surprisingly, is trust. And the question that like, how can we instill trust like kind of a between the people who, let's say, create the models and like create these data science applications, and then like people whose job is to just look at the results and like try to understand what's going on. And the challenge there is that usually there it is almost like a triangle drama between the data scientist and the, let's say, the business stakeholder, and then the model. Because oftentimes it happens that it might not be that the data scientist even understands fully, I mean, what's going on in the model. So now we have this like interesting situation that somehow the data scientist needs to convince the business stakeholder that the model actually makes sense. But I mean, in order to be able to do that, the data scientist kind of would need to understand how the model actually works and how it behaves, which is not always given. And I think, again, I mean, here, like one really important part is the first, I mean, like get to that like a first interaction like as soon as possible, because usually the kind of the saddest outcomes have come from the projects like where it took a long time to even like get to the first deployment and like get to the first interaction, and then let's say the kind of the stakeholder is disappointed on the results, and then like at that point in time already the technical team had put in like let's say 6 months of work, and then it can be quite painful to go back. But instead, imagine a situation where we can get the first useful results, let's say, out in a week. I mean, before nobody has spent too much time and resources on building something. And if the stakeholder says that this doesn't make any sense, we have to take another approach, or maybe I forgot to tell you about this one really important requirement. I mean, like, there are no hard feelings, even if you have to throw away like a week's worth of work, and then you can go back and actually do the right thing.
And one thing that I want to revisit in terms of the team composition, and what you started off with within Netflix, the no rules rules, or the high level of autonomy in decision making on how you execute your work. So Netflix is known for having an all-stars team, basically not just in data science, but basically on all frontiers. So what's your opinion? Do you think this type of a culture of autonomy requires an all-star team to work?
It's an interesting question, like what is all stars? I mean, I have seen like all-star teams in all kinds of companies. Now I know that Netflix has made a lot of noise about it. That's of course like it is true that like especially historically like Netflix has like kind of wanted to focus on especially like maybe historically like hiring more senior people with more experience, and maybe that like gives an idea that it is maybe more all-star. But I don't want to kind of give an impression that like Netflix is somehow like so unique, such a like unique snowflake that like a model couldn't be replicated elsewhere. So I mean, the fact is that there are amazing people like everywhere, like even globally as well. And so it definitely doesn't require that you are based in Silicon Valley or you have as deep pockets as Netflix. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is that I really do believe that there's a bit of a change happening. So I mean, one thing that really benefited Netflix in the old days, like I mentioned, is that like when it was required that the same people can both build the systems in C++ and they can build the machine learning models from scratch. I mean, yes, I mean, then it was useful that the company was able to hire these like unique individuals who can do it. Now, as the company scales, well, I mean, we want to invest more in diversity, having people like who can actually understand the domains, different walks of life, and so forth, and then like empower them. And I do believe that actually like the business results are even better than like what they used to be. Also, the bandwidth is way larger, so we are able to do more stuff in the same amount of time. So, I mean, all these things taken together, I would argue that like the playbook is something that like any company can do today. I'm not saying that it's easy, and like yeah, definitely it requires investments both in the culture as well as on the infrastructure side. But I mean, I think it is quite achievable for all companies.
And we are starting to reach the end of the episode, and as is customary within inference, we'd love to get a prediction out of you. So you've been at the frontier of not just building data teams, not just building infrastructures, but managing data teams and seeing the overall maturation of the AI and data science market, like all the way from its budding phase in 2011 with the toolkits into what it is today in 2021. So what's your prediction for the upcoming 48 months? What do you see as the upcoming trends on the management of data teams?
Well, I mean, like 48 months is an interesting time scale. I do think that like overall, like if you even like look at the longer time horizon, my genuine belief is that machine learning data science will become like software, and software in a sense that it is everywhere and there isn't a single way of doing it. So software as of today, it comes in all shapes and sizes. It can be small embedded system, it can be large distributed systems. Some of the softwares are small and simple, some are like extremely large and complex, and the same thing applies to ML. I do think that like also many data teams are like facing like same kind of a situation that these use cases, given that like we want to, there's appetite to apply ML and data everywhere, is that like the use cases are becoming very varied, like at different kinds, and that like poses challenges, like both technically as well as organizationally. I mean, not always you need the largest distributed systems, and like sometimes you do, and that's definitely like interesting challenge. I of course like do think that, I mean, it's absolutely inevitable that the level of abstraction and the maturity of the technical solutions really keeps increasing. I mean this is what always happens, that something that used to be extremely hard and requires special expertise in the past. I mean, I always like to use, let's say, setting up a web server as an example. I mean, like, let's say in 1997, setting up a web server like required a specialized team. I mean, nobody even thinks about setting up a web server anymore. It's just a known thing. I mean, and the same thing will happen in data and data science, that there are things that like companies worry about today. How do we find talent to make TensorFlow scale? And like many of those problems, I mean, will just simply go away.
All right. Thank you so much, Ville. And before we finish, there is a book coming out authored by you called Effective Data Science Infrastructure.
Yeah.
Is there any sneak peeks or anything you'd like to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, no, I think that like if listeners were interested in these topics that we covered today, the book will tell you much more. So the book will cover the whole like, infrastructure stack that you will need to set up an infrastructure like what Netflix uses. And I have the human-centric lens, that the question is not so much about the technical components, but also that how do we make humans productive? How do we make data scientists productive? Especially like when people come from many different backgrounds and like have different skill sets. So yeah, the book, it will be called Effective Data Science, Make Your Data Scientists Productive. It will be published by Manning, and it will be in early access in a month or so. So definitely like go check out Manning's website, and it should be come out soon.
So Effective Data Science Infrastructure, you heard it here first. Ville, thank you once more for coming on. This has been a tremendously interesting episode. And for all the listeners out there, have a great day.